It's like watching Game of Thrones, you know, when you first, if you first started watching it without knowing anything about it, like, oh, that main, the main, that's, I thought that was the main guy. He's not going to be in it for the rest of the 7 years now. Like, but who's, who's, and that, now that person's dead and that person's dead.
Well, it also throws you off in terms of pacing because you're not sure how long any one of these vignettes will take.
Hey everyone, thank you for making it so far. This is episode 101 of the FlixWatcher podcast. Hey everybody, welcome to FlixWatcher podcast. Today I'm joined by Alice.
Hello.
And Mike.
Whoop.
And as always, that's great, whoop. Helen.
Whoop whoop.
And we're going to be talking about the Coen Brothers flick, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Come find us on Twitter at FlixWatcherPod. Visit the website flixwatcher.tv for full listings and don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us an awesome review.
There will be bad language. There will be spoilers. I hope you enjoy it. See you later.
Hello, film fans. Welcome to this episode of FlixWatcher Podcast. In our studio today, we have Mike and Alice. If you would like to say hello to our listeners, please.
Hello, listeners.
I'd like to as well. Hello.
So if you can do, just give us a bit of a... Well, tell us about your podcast. Tell us about you. You're both comedians. Tell us a bit about yourselves, guys.
Sure. My name is Mike Kaplan. I live in New York City. I do comedy, I'd say mostly in America, but happily other places like here as well. We're in England right now. I don't know if that's a secret.
Well, welcome.
Thank you so much.
This is probably your last time to come here.
Absolutely.
Safely.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what is safety? I have been doing comedy for 16, 17 years. I've done it on TV a few times in America. You can search for my albums. I have a special that you can watch on Amazon. I think most places, I think Amazon took over most of the world. So my special is called Small, Dork, and Handsome. My most recent album as of this recording is called No Kidding. And my podcast is called Broccoli and Ice Cream, where I talk to guests about the work and joys of their lives as represented by broccoli and ice cream. And I think that's most of, if you search for M-Y-Q-K-A-P-L-A-N, that's Mike Kaplan, the weird way that I spell it. You'll find me on all of the social media platforms and you'll find me everywhere. Thanks for finding me.
And yourself, Alice?
Well, my name's Alice Fraser and I have also been doing comedy for a little while. I have, depending on your entry point, price point, I have a free trilogy of my stand-up specials that's available as a podcast. It's called the Alice Fraser Trilogy, and I assume you know how to get podcasts if you're listening to this. I also have my special, which is the middle one of the trilogy, that's called The Resistance, and that's available on Amazon Prime, but also on my website if you don't sign up to Amazon. And I'm kind of all over the place as well, internet-wise. It's a fun life.
So both of you are on Amazon Prime. So whoever's listening, if you have Amazon Prime, go there and type MYQ, get Mike, and get and type in Alice Fraser.
Is it wrong to be plugging shows that are on the kind of alternative to Netflix?
Netflix don't
pay us, so yeah, plug away. Yeah, so.
Mine also was on Netflix, so if that helps you.
Was, so they took it off.
It was...
too rude.
I guess so. It was recorded and like produced by not Netflix before they were creating their own content. So I think I recorded it in 2013. Mm. It appeared on Netflix from 2014 to 2017. And that was the length of like the initial contract, after which they were like, we're making our own stuff now. They didn't say that specifically, but that's my interpretation.
Well, that's what they're doing with like even the Disney stuff. They've just gone, Jessica Jones, fuck off. So they're just doing their own stuff now because yes, it's more cost effective. Right, we're here talking about their own stuff. This is The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is a Netflix original, as helmed by the Coen brothers, Joel and Ethan. Mike, you chose this film.
I did.
Can you tell us why you chose it and give us a 2-minute synopsis?
I'll do my best.
Please, the time is starting now.
So, I chose it because I'd heard a lot of people talking about it, and because whenever I opened Netflix, it popped into my face, and also because, more specifically, I do really enjoy everything, pretty much everything that I've seen by the Coen brothers. Like, I don't love it all equally, but I think it's all very interesting, like in different ways that are like appealing. And so this particular film, I would learn upon watching, is 6 short vignettes, or 6 maybe long vignettes. I don't know how short or long a vignette is. The title, the titular vignette, which I thought might have been the whole movie until it ended. I was like, wow, a lot of stuff is happening real fast. a guy, like a weird looking cowboy who sings and apparently has a lot of nicknames and reputation. And he's good at shooting guns and singing songs. And he gets into battles of both of them. And I know that I'm allowed to spoil things, but I feel like, you know, just watch it. It's delightful. The next one, James Franco is a bank robber. James Banco is a Frank robber. That's a fun thing you can say if you want. And Stephen Root is the banker that he's robbing, who is, Milton from Office Space.
Oh, is that him?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I was trying to work out where I knew him from.
Oh, yeah. He's been in so many things. He was in
Boardwalk Empire.
Oh, he's been in so much. I just watched him in an episode of The Good Wife, a show that I love. Also on Amazon, if you want to watch that.
Stop plugging Amazon.
then Liam Neeson plays sort of an old surly guy who's carting around a legless, armless orator to different towns to make money. I think that one's called Meal Ticket. And it's, I think, in some ways, the darkest of them. Ends super dark. My girlfriend, so delightful. We watched together. She was like, seeing the choice being made, she was like, okay, just don't go that direction. Just don't. She thought that he was trying to decide whether to go over this rickety cliff with their cart. But in fact, that was not the choice being made at all. Tom Waits, maybe. I really loved a lot of it. But he played a prospector, mm-hmm. finding gold, talking to the gold, and then running into potential other humans, cause a lot of trouble in this, like, such a beautiful natural world. And then we had Zoe Kazan.
Kazan, yeah.
What's that? Kumail's movie, Kumail and Emily's. The Big Sick. And there's also a sort of a big sickness in this one as well. She's traveling across the Oregon Trail. And there's trouble with money and family dying and there's
and a dog.
There's a dog annoying
dog causes
people.
Mayhem.
And also there are what quote unquote savages. I think that's maybe my least favorite part of the movie is sort of the just like straight ahead, like old fashioned, like, oh, quote, cowboys and Indians, and I'm sure there have been, of course, warlike native peoples, but that is not, I feel like that's a stereotype that is presented, and there's nothing like sort of the Western people, the white people, the cowboys are like the good guys, and I don't think that is as nuanced a view as it is my favorite these days, but I do understand the context in which it is presented. And then the final one, also one of my favorites, the first one, there's a lot of death. The last one, there's also perhaps a lot of death. There's at least some death, and it's just people riding in a stagecoach somewhere, or maybe not somewhere, who can say, and it's just like a conversation between these three characters, or five characters, a bunch of people who think that they're right and think that their way is good. Or maybe they don't think. Maybe they're just a lot of people being their different selves, I guess, is my basic summarization of kind of the whole thing.
Twitter.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was quite a long synopsis, but this film actually is split up into six parts.
So I should have had 12 minutes.
Oh, well, okay. Well, you did well with the time.
So it's very short.
Alice, what were your thoughts on Buster Scruggs and what the whole film as it's presented to us on Netflix?
I mean, I liked it very much. Some of it I didn't like. There was this kind of dark tone that kind of, I think, wore on me a little bit, a sort of a relentless, not pessimism, but cynicism about human nature in these hard conditions.
Well, every vignette has, apart from the last one where it's not so explicit, every single vignette ends in a death. And the lightest one, I guess, was the Tom Waits one where there is a death in it, but, you know, the prospector guy who we're following, he manages to escape. Everyone else, like, dies.
It's pretty death heavy.
It's pretty tragic, isn't it?
Well, yeah, so it's sort of this juxtaposition of extremely beautiful cinematography, very kind of hyper-real, intense, very color graded. Each vignette has a different tone in the visuals, and the natural world is presented as extremely beautiful if harsh, whereas human nature is presented as extremely dirty. And it's an interesting sort of flip, maybe, because it's the conceit of the of the film is that it's these stories from a book,
yeah.
an old-fashioned book in which these characters are quite two-dimensional for the most part. Their motives are obscured, even perhaps from themselves. They act without seeming to think about acting very much. Even when they're seen to be contemplating, you feel like there's wheels moving rather than thought happening. And almost inevitably they make what I would see as bad choices, or certainly harsh choices.
Also, along with the juxtaposition in the very first one, I think that tone was like the cartooniest, like
yes.
the most cartoonish, like because this man is, you know, like at sometimes like gruesomely killing people, and then breaking into song, and like, you know,
yeah.
the scene where he kills a man with a table,
yeah,
and then. Starts like jumps up and dances and sings on the bar, and everybody in the place is like singing and dancing. Like, oh, it's like, and he's like lying there like with a bloody face on the floor, and everybody else singing and dancing until, is it Jack Black like runs in?
Is it Jack Black?
It certainly looks like. No. It's certainly a man who looks like Jack Black a great amount, whether it is or not, runs in, who is the dead man's brother. And then he is the only person at that moment responding like as I think our emotions were or are, be like, he's like, you know, sobbing and playing it completely, you know, straight and dramatic in very stark contrast to the Broadway musical number that's, you know, or the Disney like singing that's going on around, everyone having a joyful time. And so I also like that sort of really set the stage to like have any that also sort of like a microcosm of what would come, is just like even within that one, you know, 10 or 15 minute or however long vignette that was, there's like such horror and such like joy being presented simultaneously.
So do you think if it had been presented in a different order, you would have found it a lot harder to swallow then? Is that what
perhaps?
Well, in that first setup,
yeah.
It tells you that anything can happen, that you can have both realistic human emotions and completely cartoonish
yeah.
events or responses from anybody. You don't know how anyone is going to react or how anyone is going to behave, because there are really no norms.
And especially, like, I sincerely didn't know it was a collection. I thought that it was one film just called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. And so when, especially... the way that it ended, like things kept happening so quickly. I was like, oh wow. When, you know, in a 2 hour, it's like watching Game of Thrones, you know, if you first started watching it without knowing anything about it, like, oh, I thought that was the main guy. He's not going to be in it for the rest of the 7 years now. Like, but who's, and that, now that person's dead and that person's dead.
Well, it also throws you off in terms of pacing, because you're not sure how long any one of these vignettes will take.
Yes.
So you're not sure what you have a sort of a sense with most movies or most television shows what the rhythm of the narrative is going to be. You kind of know what pace things happen at.
And you start to get, the first vignette was quite a short one.
Yes.
And
so
then
everything's happening so quickly, but then the second one is much more sort of relaxed in its pace. And you're like, well, maybe this is the rest of the movie, and the Buster Scruggs one was
short before a Pixar film,
yeah.
almost.
Yeah, and also that I think that's a great, I wondered as it ended, I was like, oh, this is on Netflix. It could have been like a series. It could have been, you know, six episodes of a show. But then even, I don't know if this was specific, I'm sure, like I heard a thing once, it's like assume, this is at an improv theater, just like for when you're working with people, like a sign backstage that said, assume that everyone is a genius and everything is on purpose. So whether or not this was part of their intent, I'm like, I'm sure that they put a lot more thought into this than my questioning right now. But I initially, like right after I watched it, I was like, I wonder why they didn't do it as episodes. And one reason is like, if it's an episode, they'd be like, oh, this one's almost over. At least you can look at like how long is it going to take, because you look at the bar, it's like, oh, it's half done, it's 2 minutes left. But for this, because you don't know where each chapter ends, it's, I mean, like life itself, which is a lot of, you know, what this thing is about, and what everything is about, life, death, singing, that's all it is. Like, just, you don't know. Like, you know, you're like, oh, maybe. At least you know the whole thing is, whatever, 2 hours and 13 minutes or whatever it is. That'd be nice to know for life. Yeah, your whole life is going to be, like, 90 years, but you don't know when you're going to, like, when, you know, certain physical or mental incapacities might start kicking in. So, similarly, you're like, oh, what? When is it? When will people die? Is, like, the ultimate question.
What were your thoughts, Helen?
So, I think I'm a Coen Brothers fan, although with each film that comes along, I find that I don't actually like it. So I'm questioning whether I am actually a
what
Coen
was
Brothers
one before,
fan.
One before this was Hail Caesar, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Which was also a bit vignette-y.
Yeah. But, I mean, this film is boring.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This is... I tried to watch it, likewise, Netflix. You want to watch this film? It's new. And got maybe 20 minutes in and... I think, yeah, just the death. Yeah, I didn't really want to watch that much death. And
that seems like two different things, that it boring or too much death.
But that is kind of maybe why. Maybe death should be given a little bit more weight rather than being seen as this sort of almost abstract thing. Yeah, I had to stop after the fourth one and take a break of a couple of days because it was this...
Yeah, and it's two hours and 13 minutes to sit there. So, I mean, maybe if it had been a mini-series and it had been fleshed out a little bit more, then, I don't know, you might build kind of a connection to the characters because we only meet them for so long. And are you meant to feel sorry for them? Are you meant to feel sad when they die?
Did everyone watch this in one sitting, or did everyone else have to stop it after?
I did watch it in one sitting.
Yeah, yeah. I stopped at the after the fifth one because I thought actually I could go to bed now and then just pick it up tomorrow for the last 25 minutes. It's quite interesting.
Which doesn't bode well for its engagement score.
Well, it does. I really enjoyed it, but I just thought because the opportunity was presented there and I had no real particular reason to remember what happened beforehand. I just thought, well, let's go to bed and feel fresh and watch it. Rather than be what's in the last chapter when I felt tired, I thought I'd rather watch it when I'm feeling more refreshed.
Well, I think this is interesting in part because it's one of the first things that I've seen on a mainstream kind of gatekeeper type medium that has taken advantage of the capacities of the internet, which is that you can do things for as long or as short as they need to be done. You can tell the story in whatever time it needs to be done. I remember having this fight with my trilogy because I put it up on the ABC and they said people won't listen to more than half an hour of audio at a time. And I don't know where they got that information. Obviously, they're coming from radio.
Sure.
And I said, but they're 3 1-hour shows. I wrote them as 1-hour shows. Yeah. Why can we not put them out as 3 1-hour shows? And then I'll give you 3 extra episodes. If you want a 6-episode series, I'll give you 3 behind-the-scenes episodes. And I recorded those 3. And they were like, no. We argued about this for weeks and eventually I folded and let them cut them up into half-hour episodes because they had this just intense feeling that things have to be this.
A certain
it's taking away the fact that someone would choose whether they wanted to listen to it in the 1 hour or whether they'd want to break it up themselves.
Well, yes, for me, I regularly download podcasts that are 4 hours long, Dan Carlin's Hardcore History or The Dollops, usually like an hour and a half, Mark Maron's episodes go forever, and you sort of...
You stop and start when you want to
when
on your
you
own terms.
When you want to on your terms. And I kind of wanted to play the experiment of seeing if I could pull people in for the full hour or the full 3 hours.
Do you guys know the old Yogi Berra joke where he goes into a pizza place, orders a whole pie, and they say, would you like it cut into 6 or 8 slices? And he says, you better make it 6. I don't think I could eat 8. and that, well, obviously, part of the joke is, I mean, he's like a wise fool that, like initially he seems just like a complete fool, but sincerely, like when things are like there are books that if the chapter is like every chapter is 2 pages, then I'll read more. Like I have a joke I'm working on about how like I won't generally sit down to watch a 2-hour movie on Netflix because that's a very large commitment, but I will watch 1 half-hour episode of a show and then do that 17 times in a row. Like because each time the, you know, that short period ends, you're like, oh yeah, of course I'll keep going. Yeah. I'll keep going. But it does seem like I feel like it's at least for me, you know, the idea of like the authority is like, this is an hour. You're meant to do this. You know, you go to the theater, you watch the whole movie. Obviously sometimes you have to and now you don't.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's an argument for consent as part of this process of that being repeatedly asked for consent would have made this 6-vignette movie maybe a little bit more digestible in that you might have engaged with all 6 if you hadn't been asked to watch all 6 in a row.
I'm quite shocked that you found it boring because I thought it was anything but boring. But I mean, which was your favourite vignette that you watched? Or least favourite, if that's a better way to...
Which one offended you?
The most least.
What affected you the most?
Yeah.
All right, I'll hug anyone else who's got the least favorite on. Come back, tell him when you've had a chance to think.
So the ones that I enjoyed, I guess I'm better now at enjoying things that aren't my exact favorite. Like, I feel like I've come from like a place where I wanted to just put in like maximize my experience. And if something isn't like, if I'm not enjoying it, then why go? Like, I definitely enjoyed the whole thing. Like, I loved, I really liked the first one a lot. Like, I felt like that, I like when there's singing in a Coen Brothers movie.
Like, singing at the start and the end of singing as well, in the last one.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. That was different though, in a way. But I did love the first and the last, I think, made me feel the way that a beginning and an ending, like, I liked it. I feel like the beginning started, it was like full of life and then not, and then the end was like full of death and then, and also not. And I feel like, I mean, the Tom Waits one was like the one that maybe made me feel like the most tender, and like perhaps also because it was like the most classic, like, oh, at least it ended with the bad guy, the quote unquote bad guy, yeah, dying. Like, the good guy, like the most clearly victorious, like for our, you know, our spirit and our emotional well-being, as opposed to like, I feel like the Zoe Kazan one, the you know, the Oregon Trail one was also like, I liked the characters a lot. I liked the relationships. I just love Stephen Root and the bank robbery. Like, and oh, that one had, I think, the line that I laughed at the most when James Franco, when he was being
on the gallows.
Yeah, being about to be hanged for what was his second hanging. And there's a guy losing it next to him, just like bawling. And then James Franco looks at him and he's like, first time, like, just, I mean, what a, it's like, that's a situation that almost, I mean, it couldn't, I couldn't, like, I'm like, how did, like, they constructed it, like, that, I feel like, almost couldn't happen in real life, to be like, you know, the thing that normally, like, weeks later, you'd be like, oh, I should have said that funny thing, but, like, that, yeah, yeah, it's at the gallows, at, like, the last possible chance to make a joke, only a joke wherein you had to have been almost hanged, like, just, you know, recently or once before. A thing that I think maybe it happens more than I know, but certainly I've never been almost hanged.
Maybe happens all the time in the Wild West.
It's
well, awesome. I thought that was a really interesting one as well, in terms of kind of the causation within the world and the narrative within the world. What you were being set up for was that he was constantly in danger of losing his life and not, repeatedly not. And then when he does at the end, it's a shock because it seems to be for comparatively little reason.
I thought it was going to get away somehow at the end.
And that is a thing that, I mean, I think, Helen, you brought up, you know, what are we supposed to feel, you know, about these characters and their lives, like, and especially if they're like potentially so easily lost, which again, like on a macrocosm is like, in life, what are we supposed to feel? Like, we feel as much as we do and want and can. And I think it is good to be invested in, you know, obviously people in our lives that we care about, people that we don't know, everyone that we can care about. And then then we sort of, you know, project that onto characters. And so it does seem like sometimes there is, like, speaking of consent, like, you know, an etiquette of a storyteller and the characters in a story, like, usually, like, okay, here are, like, you're going to be taken care of. You want to feel like, okay, you're not going to just be like, here's somebody that you love and immediately take, and here's another one. And so it does, at a certain point, it's like, there's a lot of calibration going on in this that is required. Like, if you prefer, like, one long story with characters that don't just die for no reason, but because that became part of just the way that these worlds worked, I adjusted to it. I was like, oh, like,
that's what's going to happen.
And so whether or not James Franco died in the end of that episode, like, I now know that I can feel, like, you know, I can feel however I want.
I thought that was interesting in that someone who does this, I think, quite well is Joss Whedon. Mm-hmm. Putting aside his private life, he is very good at setting up these narrative expectations, integrating characters into long-running plot arcs, playing on your expectations, and then killing them off extremely suddenly.
Give us an example.
But then, I mean, if we're allowed to spoil things.
Just give us the name of the TV series that you're thinking of, like Buffy, is it, or Angel?
Serenity would be one.
Sure.
So the way that he plays with that is that he then will play out the reactions of the other characters.
Mm.
So, or Buffy is another one of that, where a quite central character who everyone relies on emotionally is just taken away with no warning and for no reason.
Yeah.
In a world where people are constantly being killed by monsters, this one just dies in the way that people just die. And the emotional reactions of others are played out around them. And I think maybe this is what felt like being cheated in this series, was that you didn't really see the fallout. None of these characters seemed connected to other characters emotionally.
Yeah, there's no through thread here. And I mean, reading the reviews and hearing what people say, and obviously Helen, well, ran this table, this film does seem very divisive. And I didn't understand when people... Perhaps the reason I hadn't watched it before you recommended it was because people were saying, oh, no, it's shit. And then some people said, oh, no, it's really good. And I fell on the, oh, this is really interesting. I really enjoyed this side of the coin. Which of the vignettes can you remember that you like the least now or the most?
Well, I mean, I didn't really like any of it. The only bit I really liked was Brendan Gleeson at the end. And that was it, really. I enjoyed him singing, and that was kind of it for me. I mean, when I tried to watch this the first time around, I was watching it with some other people, and we all felt that we didn't want to continue watching it.
Oh, really?
So okay. Had you not recommended it, I would never have gone back to it.
Here's what I would say now for people listening. I assume it would be weird for people to not have seen it and now have so many things spoiled. Like, I don't know if you're... Listeners, if you haven't seen it...
Spoiler warnings before, so if they get here, then this is their own fault.
But it's a mixed bag with our listeners, isn't it? Sometimes people will just listen to the episode if they're kind of curious about the film, and then maybe go, oh, yeah, and stop it before we kind of go too deep.
Well, we've already, I think, gone this deep, but I would recommend, for anyone talking to their friends, I would recommend that people recommend watching them one at a time. Like, I sincerely...
Well, I mean, one and then go... Make a cup of tea or come back the next day.
Yeah.
As if it was a series that you've imparted yourself.
Yeah. I feel like that's now, you know, I'm fine enough doing it the way that I did, but with everything that everyone's saying, like, I think that your point is great, that let one end and then see, you know, even if you don't get to see how all the characters respond to the deaths and the happenings in it, you get to decide, you get to feel how you feel. You get to notice and think and sit. And I feel like some of them particularly, like, you know, the Zoe Kazan one, that one, I feel like when that one ended, I was like, oh, like, I feel like there was at least, you know, I feel like it ends with a character walking towards another character. And it, like, the line from the book that it reveals is like, you know,
he didn't know how I was going to explain to Mr. Knapp.
He didn't know what he was going to say. And like, oh, that's like, we saw that at the beginning. We saw that would be the last line, or that would be a line in it. And we're like, oh, which is another thing that I like, that every episode began with, you know, a page like in an old fashioned book where there's a picture from the story and then a caption of like a character saying something or the narrator saying something. And we're like, oh, I wonder what, you know, will that be? Is it ominous? Is it, you know, foreboding? Is it positive? And that one was like, it seemed ambiguous. And you're like, oh, what could that mean? And then at the end, it's like, I mean, I think that's one of the beautiful things about art.
How do you guys take to anthology series generally? Like Black Mirror is one at the top of my head where there's a thematic through line through them all, but you don't see characters appear. Do you guys, you know, do you like that when you hear a new episode, a new series of Black Mirror is coming up? Are you excited, or are you thinking, well, I wanted to spend a bit more time with the guys from White Bear or the guys from a different episode?
I think weirdly doing stand-up has made me... Well, also reading sort of novels, but stand-up particularly, you see somebody's shows over years and they might not be speaking about the same characters in their lives, but you know it's their world, the world in which they live. And so I quite like that idea. I think Black Mirror and this movie, Buster Scruggs, both tend towards darkness. Mm. And I'm not sure if the form lends itself to that because of not needing to be long-term connected to any of the characters, which means that the writers feel more free about ruining them, or ruining their lives or playing them out in full, which I think can be depressing. I don't watch Black Mirror anymore, partly because I think it's a very depressing view of the world.
Yeah, I mean, life is kind of hard enough and entertainment when you're watching it and it's telling you, yeah, this is really fucked up. I'm a bit like, yeah, I know that. Can you say something a bit different?
I understand completely what you are saying. And I think obviously everyone's life experience is different. And perhaps if you've had an easier life in some ways, then you will engage with darkness differently. But similarly, as a comedian, like I've seen like some comedians will talk about, let's say, cancer. And like there might be people in the audience who have dealt with that, who then find it cathartic and connecting. And there might be other people that are like, please, like I deal with it. I've dealt with this thing enough. Like I think sometimes people engage with certain kinds of art to, you know, to connect. And sometimes they engage with it to escape.
Tig Notaro, when she was diagnosed with cancer, and she, the first thing she did was go on stage and release. And you can tell for her, that's what she needed to do after a horrible period in her life. That was the way she had it, got it out there. And that like 20 minute section of stand-up, I'd listen to that quite often. And I think sometimes cry at the end of it because it's so powerful.
Oh yes. And which is also different slightly than what we're talking about, where like Black Mirror isn't somebody being like, oh, my memories were put into a tiny version of myself and then tortured for weeks and weeks, and so that's why I have to get this art out there. But I do think that I completely understand why someone might not want to go down, you know, the darkness rabbit hole that they do. But sometimes, like sometimes when, for me, when I feel like it used to be, if I experienced sadness, I'd be like, well, I don't want to do that. I'd like to experience happiness. So I like won't address it. I won't process it. I'll just sort of like, you know, wait and not ignore it, but just like focus on, like seek out different emotions, seek out, you know, like positive things, joyful things. And now, I mean, not to say that I don't still have tendencies to do that, but now at least sometimes when I'm feeling a way that I wouldn't wish myself to feel, I'll be like, oh, I'm feeling that way. I'm like, hey, I'm supposed to feel good. I'm like, oh no, I'm not supposed to feel good. Ah, that makes me feel better. And so I think that sometimes, you know, art that, you know, presents a potentially realistic, if not, you know, cynical view of some parts of life can also provide that release to be like, oh yeah, like if somebody's feeling anxiety or is, you know, potentially, if not clinically depressed, be like, to know that other people are experiencing these things can be resonant and connecting as well.
It sounds like the overall plot to Inside Out.
Yeah.
Right, we're going to get to the score soon, but like I did ask generally, but no one had given me a definitive answer which was their favourite or not vignette. I'm going to go to you, Alice, before we go into the score. Which ones struck you most or least?
I don't know that I would say I have a favourite. I feel like I'm maybe more on Helen's side of this in that I didn't enjoy it hugely. Mm. Well, I enjoyed parts of it. I'm torn about it. Some of the visuals were incredible.
Yeah.
And as such, I think the most beautiful looking one was probably The Prospector. And the one that I found the saddest was The Orator.
Yes.
Okay.
Because
Meal Ticket.
Meal Ticket.
Yeah.
Because it was maybe more connected to experiences that I've seen. It was very much a metaphor for the entertainment industry.
By the way, you guys are busting your asses off, and then there's some clown like falling over on their ass, and they're attracting more attention.
Yes, the sort of the randomness of the taste of the audience.
Yeah.
And in this instance, this sort of very beautiful and gone time where people were willing to sit and listen to oratory and art that I think is no longer really...
Because that was a powerful... When they first did it, even though you didn't hear the full speech, any of the speeches that the orator did, it was really kind of... I was like taken aback by it and the way they set it up and pulled out the curtain.
Oh, yeah. It was a fabulous production and well-received the first time.
The first time. Do you guys recognise who the orator was?
I remember looking up the actor, but I've forgotten because I'm terrible with names.
Well, he played Dursley in Harry Potter.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah.
He was a very solid actor.
Yeah. I was quite surprised when I was like, that's completely not what I thought he'd be doing now, but good for him.
Yes.
Mike, yourself?
I mean, the one I definitely, I loved, I liked a lot of it more than a lot of people perhaps, and less than others, he said, saying nothing. The last one, I think, is one that I would want to, like, watch again, like, right now. I think I would, if I had to watch one over and over again, maybe the Prospector made me feel good while it was happening. Because some of it is, like, you can see it once, and then once you know what it is, like, you're like, oh, like, it's like, oh, there's the surprise, if it's a surprise type thing. But some of the, like, I love watching the the banker. But yeah, if I had to pick one, which I don't, you can't make me.
There's a gun to your head.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first one is the most like representative of the whole thing as like, you know, the wacky, like, you know, who knows what could happen. But yeah, I guess I'll say the last one. The final one really like impacted me in a specific way because of also like, I think there's no specific clarity. You get to do a lot more like thinking and wondering and feeling about lots of things in it.
I think I'd go for the Prospector one. I just thought Tom Waits by himself telling that story against that backdrop. And there's the kind of analogy to humans coming in, scaring off the animals, and you know, it's an analogy for what's happening in the world right now, isn't it?
And it does have singing in it as well, a little bit. And at the end,
Mother
I feel
McCree,
like
I think the song he's singing.
Yeah, and then the animals they do get to come back at the end when the humans are gone.
Exactly.
That is.
And
nice.
The lights, you know. Yeah, him calling Mr. Park.
I didn't see that as ending it particularly hopefully because he has been shot in the gut, which in those
days. But it went clean through.
Yeah, but that's not how gut shots work.
Well, I think
it's
that's
the worst place to be shot, isn't it?
Yeah,
because it basically all the bile and everything in your gut attacks the body from the inside.
Real quick.
I mean, I think this is just a Rorschach for like whatever you feel like. The way that it could go, we see the next scene. It would be really fun. You know, like Doug Benson, the comedian, did an album once where it was every track was a sequel, a continuation to the album that he did the year before. And so I'd like to see that for this. I'd like to see the next scene, you know, another vignette for each.
Okay.
Why not?
Well, that might be Buster Scruggs too. Yeah. Well, Buster doesn't make it, so...
Well,
we'll find
they
out.
Can do other stuff. They can do a prequel.
They can repair gunshot wounds to the head. Okay, guys, we're going to go to the scores. The first score is for recommendability out of 5. Mike, you chose this, and you can go to decimal places, as many as you want. Out of 5, how highly would you recommend...
The
Buster Scruggs. I can't say that this morning. It's very early, guys. We're recording on a Saturday morning.
It's a difficult thing to mathematize because like there are certain things that I recommend, you know, that I would be 100% the highest number to everybody, even if, you know, not everybody will enjoy everything. Like Calvin and Hobbes, you know, like everyone should. The Muppets, you know, that sort of thing. The Princess Bride, perhaps. Like, but for some things, I'm like, you know, if somebody's like, oh, listening to this or thinking about it, or I like the Coen brothers, like, I think I want to see it. Do you think I should see it? I'm like, if you think you want to, then do. And if somebody's like, I don't know, I don't think I want to, then I'd be like, then don't. So I feel like similarly, this number is not going to be for everyone, but I'll give it a 4.5 out of 5. We're doing out of 5?
Out of 5,
okay,
yeah.
Great. Yeah.
Alice.
I think that it is worth watching, even if you find out that you don't enjoy it, because I think it's interesting and the things that it tries are worth trying. I'm a big believer in failure. I think this is probably a very interesting failure. So I would say more recommendation than not recommendation. Give it a 3.5.
Which one?
Make it 3.5. Let's be positive.
Yeah.
Helen.
I was going to go lower, but I've kind of been talked around listening. So I'm going to give it a 2. I mean, I did not enjoy this, engage with it at all. And if that's not a game, I knew I like vignettes in a film and I like chapters in films and, you know, multi-story plotline films, but nothing about this I was engaged with or cared about. I mean, I don't like Westerns as a genre, so maybe I was never ever going to like this anyway because of its content. I would say if you haven't seen it and you're a Coen Brothers fan, then you should probably see it. But I mean, wasn't for me. So 2.
Yeah, I'm going to go for a 4 here. I really enjoyed it. I'm more than I thought I was going to, because I think I felt like I wasn't going to, because Hail Caesar had some fun bits, but generally I thought it was a bit dull as an overall kind of concept.
I loved Hail Caesar as a sort of a beautiful tribute to the golden age of Hollywood, but...
I guess I was going in there expecting a proper cohesive story, which they kind of presented, but then it wasn't that. My favorite bit was the dancing, the same
Channing
Tatum dancing. Was that him dancing?
Yeah.
Great.
I mean, he made his career on Step Up, right?
Mm.
He's a legit dancer.
I saw him dancing in Magic Mike and Magic Mike XXL. But yeah, I think it's going to be caveated that if I recommend it to people, like you say, Mike, if someone says, should I watch it? Then I'll be like, if you think you should watch it, yeah, I think you probably enjoy it because you've been considering it. And if you like Coen Brothers, as Helen says, absolutely watch it, because if you like Coen Brothers, it doesn't mean anything because their films are wildly different. And yeah, give it a go.
And it's also interesting, like, to look, if you just look at the average of even our, you know, we all widely varied on how we felt about it. It's like you could have a thing that the average is 3, where it was all 3s, and then I would say, ah, who cares? You know, you got a 60%.
Yeah.
But if you have something that's like, you know, a bunch of 5s and a bunch of 1s, like that's interesting.
Yeah.
So I think this is like more like that.
Repeat viewing score, Mike.
I'll give it a 4. Yeah, I'll give it a 4.
Okay. Manny, for that last section.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely. Like, I haven't repeated viewing it yet, but I definitely plan to repeat view at least some of it.
Well, that's a good thing. It's a shame it's not divided up into chapters on Netflix so you can scrub through.
But you can find it.
Yeah, I guess so.
I don't think I would watch it again. I'd give it a 2. I'm glad that I did,
yeah.
But I don't think I'd do it again.
Helen?
I've already done 1 and a bit. I am not going to go back. It's a big fat 0.
0. I'm going to go for a 4. I definitely will watch some parts of it again, and maybe not all of it, but I really genuinely took something from each section, and the last one left me a bit depressed, so maybe I'd do the same thing again where I watched the first 5. I thought the fourth one was quite depressing, the way Zoe kills herself at the end.
Oh yes. It's very sad.
Yeah, that's pretty dark. So maybe watch the first 4, leave it the prospect, and then come back and hit up the last 2.
Or watch them in a different order. Put them in your own order.
True, yeah. So I'm going to go for 3.5.
All right.
Okay, small screen score. Do you want an explanation of this one, guys?
Yes, please.
So small screen score is, so if it has a... if you really want to see this in a cinema with a, you know, the biggest screen possible on IMAX, then it's a low small screen score. So these scoring systems based on the fact you're watching it on Netflix and at home, potentially. So if it works well for a small screen, so some documentaries or, you know, smaller films, you think, if I'd gone to the cinema, I would have been pissed off that I'd spent £15 on a ticket, then the home screen experience is the best. And that's a, that's a 5.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I'd say then I'm very happy that I watched it without going anywhere, so I'll say it's a 5.
Yeah, I would agree, which surprised me, for something that has such incredibly vast cinematography and such precise focus in the way that the cameras are used. It was also clearly built for the small screen, and so I'd give it a 5 for that.
Helen?
See, this is really interesting because I was watching it, and as I was watching it and checking my emails and making my dinner, I was thinking, if I'd have seen this at the cinema, I would be more forced to engage with it, and I would have sat through all of it without, you know, getting up and not pausing it, and it would have made me do that. So
does that relate more to the engagement score than the small screen?
But also a little bit in that it's, had it been a series, or like, you know, like a like you said, you know, you could put your own order in them, then I feel I may have engaged with it slightly better. So in that it's format as a film, but for being made for the small screen, it's kind of shot itself in the foot, where it could have been made filmatically as a TV series. Mm. It could have been better, if that makes sense.
It's sort of, it's not exactly this, but it's sort of like, you know, the food is so expensive, it's food is bad and the portions are so small, you know?
Yeah.
Like I didn't like it, but if they had showed it to me and I couldn't stop watching it, then maybe I would have enjoyed being made to enjoy it.
Yeah. So, I don't know, and I think, I mean, I will admit, you know, the scenery and the way it looks, they've made it as a film, but we're obviously consuming it on our TV screens, and that they put all this effort in to make it look so beautiful. Why shouldn't it be on a big screen and to have that experience and kind of be taken into this mini world they've created? So I think normally I'm quite a fan of films that have been made, you know, for Netflix, and I think it's a great idea that they're giving us this opportunity to watch it in our home. But I think with this, you know, it's been made as a film and it should be viewed.
I don't know whether it was a Netflix buy-in or if they were.
But I didn't see it got a release over here in the cinemas. I can't remember seeing it
in America as well. There, it's in some like physical,
a very
places.
Limited.
Yeah.
But I do believe it was produced by Netflix.
So they came to Netflix and said, "We got this idea." Netflix said, "Here's some money.
I think Netflix came to them and said, "We'll give you some money. Do something interesting."
Okay. So this is
So I'm going to go straight down the middle with 2.5 because I think I would have maybe engaged more with it, or at least it would have forced me to had I watched it in the cinema.
I'm going to go for a 1 here. I thought some of the scenery was stunning. And with a Wild West, with a big kind of expansive kind of road movie type thing, and it wasn't a road movie, but it had some, the Oregon Trail, example, looked amazing. The prospect looked amazing. Segment looked amazing. I think I would have enjoyed it more in the cinema. And the Coen brothers tend to have either the really intimate films or, something like No Country for All Men. That looks amazing in the cinema, for example.
Yeah, I mean, most of the films that I've seen of theirs, I've always tried to go and see them in the cinema.
I mean, Roger Deakins was there. De facto cinematographer, which meant that you want to see it in a cinema, and this guy's taken over him is doing a great job as well. So I would like to have seen this in a cinema for the way they set
it up. I think
it
might have been a bit overwhelming in a cinema.
Oh, really?
Because the focus was so precise, it was sort of over sharpened. I think it might have been a bit painful to watch in a cinema.
Oh no!
Well, for 2 hours and 13 minutes, probably a bit painful as well.
Engagement score, Mike, how engaged were you whilst watching? Did you feel the need to check IMDb, Wikipedia, do your taxes?
The only thing that I wanted to check was a thing that you guys know on Amazon when you watch shows, like you can move the cursor and then they show you the actors and the songs and there were so many actors in this, they're like, who is that? What are they? How do I? And so I feel like that is like the only, that is more engagement with it. I wanted to be able to engage more, but I did. So I did engage maximally. And it was a little long, but I feel like the fact that it was, six, not bite-sized, but like, I liked there being beginnings and endings. And it didn't just like fly through, but I'll get a 4 for that.
Alice.
Well, I stopped watching after The Prospector, so I'll give it a 3.
Why did you stop? You said you just wanted to take a break.
I took a break for a couple of days. I couldn't stomach more of it. So by definition, I only engaged with 2/3 of it. So
Helen?
I'm trying to think. I can't remember the last time I was so unengaged with a film, and it's really weird. And I don't know if it's, the what I've said before about not seeing it in the cinema, which I think would have helped, but I just really, it just didn't do anything for me. And I only watched it until the end because obviously,
you were required.
I was required to, and I would have never ever come back. So a 0.
Oof.
I know. Sorry. I mean, I was just trying to think, we've had films before, which I should have liked this film, or I should have felt a bit more, or I should have been able to go, I kind of like this story, but I wasn't so much of a fan of that one. But I really didn't like this film.
I'm surprised that, well, the Twitter reaction, which we'll come to shortly, was kind of divided as well, but I'm quite surprised that there wasn't at least one which you thought, that's my boy.
I mean, I guess I kind of enjoyed seeing Tom Waits on the screen, but other than that, I didn't.
That's fair enough. Well, It's your own reaction.
You're not in trouble.
Exactly.
You did the assignment.
I'm gonna go for 4 here. I did really enjoy it. And at the start, I was like, didn't really get what was going on with the singing cowboy. And I thought, if that's going to be this kind of story all the way through, I thought it was going to be like a narrator.
Oh yeah.
Kind of going through it. And then when it changed to a different style with James Franco, and he's obviously going to rob the bank. The bank teller fights back on him, and Franco thinks he's got away with it, but then the bank teller comes out with the pans on his head, and all this kind of nonsense is going on. The next thing, he's on a horse and he's nearly been hanged, and I just had no idea what was going to happen next. So for that kind of setup, I was like, okay, I'm going to keep on watching this and I'm fully invested.
I mean, the costume design was astonishing. And I'm going to say this in the wrong way because I only know her as Mari Valeriano's wife, Mary, who did the costume design, which you shouldn't refer to people by reference to who they're married to. But she had this incredible, the costume design was amazing, and particularly that Pots and Pans outfit was hilarious and sort of sad at the same time. And that was all in the costuming.
And that gives us an overall score of 3.03. So three out of five stars, and let's head to the Twitter and find out what people are saying.
So when we review films, if you follow us on Twitter, we will always put a shout out with a little GIF. We'll say we're reviewing the name of the film and our guests, and ask the followers to share your reviews.
So with the first review, Mike, can you take the first review from these guys?
Just read it?
Yes, please.
Oh, yes. It's another jumbled mess by the hit or miss Coen brothers. Started off strong, but went downhill quickly. Pretty to look at, but nonsensical. At least it wasn't A Serious Man.
I quite enjoyed A Serious Man. They stalked. That was a Besotted Geek Pod.
Did they come back with a star rating? They didn't do the little star rating.
They didn't come out with a star rating. Alice, can you take the next one?
4 stars and one of my favourite movies of 2018. The stories range from slapstick to darkly comedic to tragic. Beautiful cinematography and a beautiful score by Carter Burwell. A great latter-day movie by the Coen brothers, and that's by somebody called The Superiority Complex.
And then they bumped it up to 5 stars because Mike liked that comment. I don't know, it's currying favour there, Mike.
Doing what I can.
Helen, do you want to say next one?
Yeah, so the next one is from Easy Riders Raging Podcast, one of our previous guests. As with all anthology films, this is a mixed bag, but it's a mixed bag by the bloody Coen brothers, so it's a hell of a lot better than most films you'll see. Well worth checking out, 4 stars, with my highlight being the Tom Waits story, which looked amazing.
Mike, do you want to say the next one?
Sure. From Top Film Tip, quick-witted gunslinging singers, gold prospecting murderers, innocent lovers, executions escaped, and otherworldly journeys in Coen's Western anthology, # The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, slightly disappointing mixed bag of fools / gold. And then there appear to be 2 guns and 5 pickaxes.
2 out of 5 there, they're saying. Alice?
Tom Hanks Defense Force says, Jack loved it, but thought the first few stories were better. I don't know who Jack is in this story, but...
It was a vague review.
Tom, who is Jack? Come back to us. And the last person has just tweeted, they've just sent a link to another tweet they did, so they haven't done it for us specifically. So it's kind of a mixed bag here. Some people, 2 out of 5. Yeah, half the people said they loved it, half the people said they didn't, which is what we kind of got around the table. So, guys, if you like the Coen brothers, watch it, but don't expect to necessarily like it, I think is the... Is the outcome of that?
I think I also, like Helen, Westerns aren't my immediate go-to. Mm. Like, that's not a genre. I've definitely loved some, but it's not like dumb action movies is kind of I think I'll see a good dumb action movie. But
yeah, I think Westerns were the superheroes of early Hollywood.
Yeah, one more note that I wanted to add is in the very first vignette. Like when he comes into the bar and sits down at a card table, I'm like, ooh, I do love poker movies. Like I love poker scenes. And then all of a sudden it's not that anymore. And I'm like, well, this is, I wish they'd played poker.
Well, there's a good poker film called Rounders.
Oh, of course. I've seen. Yes.
Good.
There's for poker films.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of them.
Guys, can you let us know how people can find you who are listening and say thank you very much and goodbye to those guys?
I will do that. Mike Kaplan is who I am. At MYQKAPLAN, wherever you want to find it. Albums, podcasts, specials, oh my. And thank you very much for listening and for having me.
And I'm Alice Fraser, FRASER. And I can be found on Twitter at Alliterative, ALLITERATIVE, or I put up blogs and videos on my Patreon, which is patreon.com/AliceFraser.
Fantastic.
Great. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. Bye.
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 Thanks for listening to FlixWatcher Podcast. Leave us your 5-star review on iTunes, follow us on Twitter at FlixWatcherPod, And if you aren't already, get yourself subscribed.
Thank you so much to Brendan Russell for his amazing editing skills, and to the lovely people, mighty people, for the tunes that you can hear right now.